Accession number 27243, Mr. Don Reynolds, Reel 9. Now, we're talking about the time, the 2 months or so you spent basically off the coast of Normandy. What happened? I mean, we talked about going back for more ammunition, and we talked also about the arrival of the Mulberry Harbour. What other things do you remember from that period?
Well, we did see the arrival of the Mulberry, and also, of course, the Pluto, the pipeline under the ocean, was another of the big things that had quite a bearing on the outcome of the war. One couldn't envisage tankers full of petrol and the rest of it coming across to keep the forces going. And the pipeline under the ocean meant that they could pipe fuel from the British coast straight to where it was needed on the French side. Everything went reasonably well on the invasion, but we were pinned down, or the army was pinned down, on what was virtually the front that we were watching and helping. And we saw the flight, the bomber flights and the rest of it that came over. And generally we sat there on the coast doing whatever was necessary, any escort jobs that they thought were required, because there were still problems with the odd E-boat trying to get in and that sort of thing. And we sat on virtually the end of the battle zone, and along the coast were batteries that occasionally lobbed shells in and tried to cause confusion to the harbour and to people like ourselves who were simply sitting there as targets. And of course, as soon as any shore battery opened up, an immediate note was taken of where they were firing from, and within minutes almost they were being attacked either by people like ourselves or by some of the rocket firing landing craft type jobs that did a very good job to keep them quiet. But it was a little bit difficult sitting there waiting for a shell to come over, almost inviting it at times, and it would have caused quite a bit of a confusion had we had a hit. Things weren't too bad. I did recall from a little while ago, we mentioned the trip to Portsmouth. When we returned, we found that the boat that we had that had replaced us on our guard roll on that extreme end had actually been sunk, and all we could see was about the top 10 or 12 feet of its mast. Very difficult. It makes you wonder, you know, what stroke of fate meant that you were away when this sort of thing happened. And I think it actually ran over a mine, and these were the things, acoustic mines and so on, were being tried out, and the E-boats and so on, of course, came in and fired the odd thing. And occasionally, we people who were on the boats didn't know what had caused the problem. It's quite something when you get a message to expect 500 planes come over and so on, and they come over, everybody's sort of cheered and they wonder where on earth they're going to go and what they're going to do. But the air supremacy was quite something. I don't recall anything else of great import on the front. We were there for several weeks, and then we moved off from there, and I think we took on our last convoy to Russia. I think that would be probably September time.
That's okay. About September, yeah.
And that
what do you remember of that convoy?
Well, the big thing about that convoy, of course, was that the weather was so good. Daylight, which was something that we weren't really used to. We'd done most of the bulk of our convoys during the very dark winter weather. And it is rather different if you're doing it in total daylight. And it's rather different to doing the sweeps up the Norwegian coast against the Tirpitz or that type of thing. So that you get used to the idea of seeing the Focke-Wulf or whatever aircraft going round in the daylight, just out of gunfire range and so on. You know that every move you make is being reported and is being conveyed to the U-boats and so on that can be set on to you. But I think we didn't have any major problems on that convoy. I can't recall anything. And when we were up there, it was fairly good weather, and we got ashore a little bit for walking around, and some of the chaps had a game of football and this type of thing. And that was the time when the Russians, of course, appeared rather more friendly. I think they, knowing that the Second Front was on the move, it did alter things, because they'd been shouting for a Second Front for a number of years. And I'm sure Uncle Joe was rather pleased about the commencement. So that convoy and the return convoy went reasonably well. And we had, I think, a refit or a mini refit and so on. And it became obvious that later on we were going to be sent elsewhere.
Do you know what the refit was? What was done?
I don't think there was a lot of major alteration at that time. I'm not sure whether that was when we altered some of our Orlikans to Bofors. And when you're moving 20 millimetre close range weapons to 40 millimetre or something like that, you feel as though you've got a little bit more clout against aircraft and well, against anything really. And whereas I had been chiefly on the 4.7 guns, I now became a Bofors gunner.
Which one? Do you know where it was in the ship?
I was on the starboard fore gun. That's just below the bridge.
And what did you think of the Bofors gun?
They were a great weapon, Memory is a little bit indistinct now about all the things about it.
What was it like to fire?
Quite interesting, quite exciting.
How did you do it? What was it? How did it all work?
Yes, that's a little bit hazy too. With the Orlikan, you used to sit in an enclosed emplacement almost that swiveled. Now on the Bofors, I think it was rather different in that the two of you who were controlling the thing were on either side of the gun, one doing the laying and the other the traversing. And you weren't nearly as well protected, as I recall. So that when shells or bullets of any description are coming inboard, you're a little bit more exposed. And that We didn't worry about that, of course, until it started to happen, and that was another 6 months on.
Did you prefer the Beaufort to the Oerlikon, though?
I think so. You felt that you were able to put a little bit more power into your efforts. The range was better and everything else. The others were really, really close range weapons, and the Beaufort gave you that much more scope for attacking and or defending even.
So what happens next then? Well, one thing is, in April, which is stepping back a bit, you've been made an able seaman. Did that make much difference to you?
I don't think it made anything at all difference, except purely in the financial side. We carried on doing exactly the same work. We didn't get any privileges or anything else. It just meant that we were classed as being reasonably competent as seamen.
Now, the other thing, just to pick up, we hadn't mentioned the rum ration. Did you take the rum ration?
Yes. Now, I'm trying to think, when did we get the rum ration? Whether it was at a certain age, I suppose. If so, it was probably 18, in which case I would have had the rum ration all the time on board. I can't really remember when it started, but certainly I did take the rum ration, and no reason to not take it, really. And it was always an enjoyable thing. It warmed one up in cold climes, and it was a rather funny thing, really, because some people, quite against the rules and regulations, used to pop theirs in a bottle for when they felt like using it, being at party time or when they were wanting to go ashore. But they preferred to do it that way. I never thought of that. It was best to use it and be done with it. But the carry-on that used to go with it, The Naffy man, the Jack Dusty, as we called him, used to have his store down in the one of the after flats, one just be just astern of our own mess deck. And when Up Spirits was piped at 10 to 12 or whatever, the people from each mess used to go down there with their billy can. And the officer of the watch would be there, and he'd see that it was carefully measured out from the rum jars, so many in each mess, and so on. And he'd see that the right amount was being measured out, and was being tipped into the billy can. And of course, the thing was that some of the brighter characters used to try to see that the amount of water that was supposed to be 2 to 1 was as minute as possible. And if you could distract his attention by any means at all, then you only got 1 for 1 and so on. You very rarely got away with it pure neat. But it added a little bit of zest to life if you were had anything to do with that measuring out. Yes, it wasn't something that people didn't have. Normally, I think most people did draw their ration.
Now, what happened next then? You've had your refit, you're on the Oerlikon, the Beaufort, sorry, on the Beaufort now. What's the next thing you remember?
I think after this refit, and I'm not quite clear, I haven't any records that tell me when it was or where it was, but comes the end of the year, and preparations were being made for going east.
Now, what preparations were they?
I don't know that there's anything particular, except we were being sort of licked into shape. Everything after the refit was being sort of brought up to a pretty high level, so that we were prepared for whatever was likely to come. And nobody would tell us what was happening, of course, until we'd sailed. And when we did sail, which was, I think, just very early in the new year, January 45, we set off and we went down to Gibraltar. Now, Gibraltar was only, I think, just to be an odd stop over before we proceeded through the Med. But for some reason, some silly ass decided that he didn't want to go east, I think, and he put some sand or something into some of the lubricating oil and caused a bit of confusion. And it meant that we stayed in Gibraltar for an extra day or two. This was all very well, but it did give me a chance to see a little bit of Gibraltar on the way out east rather than perhaps on the way back.
And what were your impressions of Gibraltar?
I was quite impressed with it. We all knew what a fortress it was and so on, and we knew that the Navy were virtually in charge of the place. But the huge fleet cinema and the rest of it were quite an eye-opener. There was a hall there that was simply a fantastic hangar, where they did put on the shows and the films and all the rest of it. And whilst we were there, we were with the things moving reasonably well on the French front and into Germany. Things were beginning to brighten up, and they were beginning to release things that had been in store in the massive tunnels and so of the rock, and one could get rations of white of chocolate and this sort of thing that had been in stock for a little while, relatively cheap. This sort of thing. It was all very interesting. After being in England, where everything was very, very tight still. One thing I remember about the rock was that I had the experience of working in one of the gunnery domes, where you took your position on the gun that you were manning on board, and the equipment showed the approaching aircraft. Coming in the dome, you got the noise and everything else. Everything was very, very realistic, and you were able to lick yourself into shape as it would be in actual action situations. And I found that was very interesting. I think I visited the dome twice, and I'm sure that later on I'd got the benefit of that practice.
And It was realistic, was it?
It was very realistic.
And it was of the Bofors?
Yes, so whichever gun you were on, they gave you the correct film and everything else. And these things don't seem to be particularly great these days, but in 60 years ago, I think they were sort of forerunners of things to come.
Anything else about Gibraltar?
The only other thing about Gibraltar was that whilst we were there, we had the mother and father of all storms. And the storm blew one or two boats that were in the inner harbour off their buoys or off the ships that they were actually attached to. And I think for a few minutes there was a bit of panic there as ships tried to get up steam sufficiently to have enough way so they didn't bump into other ships. And it was quite something. I never thought that Gibraltar would have a storm that was quite as bad as that. Now, from there, of course, we set off along the Med. We were there for just a few days. I don't think it was very long. But we set off along the Med, and at the far end we saw the snow on the peaks of Cyprus and went in to Port Said, which is the first really different type of place that most of us had been. We got a short shore leave there, just to walk ashore, and we saw...
What were your impressions, sir?
Well, it was quite Egyptian, let's put it that way. There were the young lads trying to drag you into the shops to buy this, that and the other. There were all sorts of things that we hadn't seen previously in the shops. And really, quite a remarkable change from anything. The real bizarre type of thing. I think probably that was the first really foreign food most of us had tackled as well. And the sun, of course, was the other thing. The sun was shining, as you would expect out there. We only had probably one little run ashore, because we were waiting for the boats, of course, used to go through the Suez Canal. It's one way only at a time. And you have to wait for a bit of a convoy to get together to go through the first part of the canal down into the main, I forget the name, what they call it now, the lake anyway, the lake at the far end. And when the convoy was ready, then we set off behind the trailblazer, straight down the centre of the canal. We were seeing the camels and the rest of it going along the sides and the rest. Very much the type of thing you see nowadays on the travelogues on the TV. Until we got into the Great Lake, and there were a couple of I think Italian battleships that had been there for some considerable time. But we carried on down into the Red Sea, and the next stop really was in Colombo, and that again was quite a change to get in.
Were you going to be based at Colombo, or was that?
No, it was purely a stopping off place, I think.
What did you think of Colombo? That's in Ceylon, isn't it?
Yes, Ceylon as it was in those days. Yes, the harbour there was a bustling place, and it had got a what I would consider to be an old wooden jetty and so on that one went into, and very much the sort of scene that you would have seen in the round the world in 60 days, 80 days, whatever it was. I forget now which one it
80.
Is 80 days, where you get the crazy old taxis and the rest of it there to carry away the passengers that are coming on shore and the rest of it. And that again, it all added to the experience that we were going to be having out in the East. But we didn't stay there very long. I think we dropped off there and then carried on almost at once round to what was to be our main base at Trincomalee. That's
also at Ceylon, isn't it?
Yes, yes it is. It's on the northeast coast. And a great harbour. Very pleasant tropical shoreline and the rest of it. And difficult to remember, but there must have been quite a lot of the Royal Navy out there. I'm amazed to read the books these days to see how many Navy vessels were out there. It really was amazing that there were as much so many boats in the fleet that could be spared to be out east. Although, of course, the Atlantic was getting a little bit better by now. We didn't need them all out there doing escort duty.
So what happened when you got there? You got there in February, I presume?
Yes, I think in February. Yes. I don't think there was very much that we did immediately. We probably got acclimatised and this sort of thing.
Now, how did you find the climate?
Some people wilted a little bit. I didn't find it too difficult. I suppose at times we did use to rig awnings and the rest of it to keep the real heat of the sun off the decks. But we spent as much time on the top deck as we could. We had swimming over the side and the rest of it, certainly in the afternoon and this sort of thing. And usually they treated us fairly well. We had a watch ashore each afternoon and this sort of thing. Although there was precious little to do. As I recall, Trincomalee was quite a small village. It hadn't got a lot going for it.
So what would you do when you went ashore?
I think chiefly walk around, and occasionally you might stop somewhere for a meal, although one was always a little bit careful what one ate. We were warned, I think, not to be trying all the different things that were going to be available. And yes, the heat and so on, it wasn't too extreme, and you found that on the shore there were trees and so on that gave a certain amount of shade if you wished for shade.